Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in the American West. I'm your host, Stephen Hausman. Today, I'm speaking with Frederick Brown, an independent historian based in Seattle and the author of The City is More Than Human, an animal history of Seattle, which was published by the University of Washington Press in 2016 and last year won the Western History Association's Hal K. Rothman Prize for Best Book on the Environmental History of the American West. Fred, welcome to the New Books Network.
Thanks. It's my pleasure to be here.
First, why don't we begin by having you tell us a bit about yourself? How did you become interested in history in the first place?
Okay, well, I followed a kind of circuitous route to graduate school in environmental history, but I've been a book indexer and librarian through most of my 20s and 30s and always interested in ideas and books and academic study. But then I started coming across books by Richard White and Matt Klingel's dissertation about Seattle and just found that environmental history was a very interesting field I might be interested in getting a graduate degree in. So I attended the University of Washington and got a graduate degree in environmental history. And I just found a really useful way to think about the environment, maybe in more complex ways than mainstream environmentalism does, and also a way to think about history, bringing in that important relationship between human beings and the rest of nature.
Could I ask you briefly about your book indexing work? Because I realize that's not a field that I really know much about. What is that process like and how did you get involved in that in the first place?
I got involved in that in my early 20s and when I was a perpetual graduate student, first in French studies, and I got a job in a book indexing firm in New York that did book indexes for many of the major publishing houses in New York. And I kind of learned starting with proofreading and then doing indexes. But the process is to read the book and do the obvious thing, like take names that should be in the index, but then think about what is each page about or what is each paragraph about and what are the terms the author is using, what are the synonyms that you want to relate to each other, and then construct a structure of the ideas to put in the index. So I've been doing that off and on for the last 30 years and not very much the last 10 years, but it's a good way to read some books and in a kind of different way thinking about the structure of the ideas and how would users want to access those ideas from the index.
So turning to the book at hand then, what brought you to the topic of animals in Seattle specifically?
Well, I think I've always been struck by the paradoxes and complexities of how we relate to animals, how, you know, generally people tend to love cats and dogs and be indifferent to the lives of faraway cattle, pigs, and chickens. And in my own life, I kind of saw those contradictions growing up in college towns in Oklahoma, seeing pets in the city and then visiting my grandparents' farms and seeing the very different lives of cattle on farms, and it seems like there's just this strong paradox that even as you go through time, as we talk more and more about being animal lovers and there's more and more rhetoric about concern for animals, the lives of most animals that are important to us, the livestock animals, have tended to become worse and worse. So there are these incredible contradictions that made me think this is a very interesting topic to look at and to think through. And so when I was in graduate school, I managed to find a number of very interesting documents in the municipal archives in Seattle about how people related to their dogs and cats and the cows in the city. And so I got rolling with that as part of my dissertation and then turned it into a book.
Could you talk a little bit more about the archival research that you did for this book? Because for those that haven't gotten the opportunity to hold it in their hands yet, there's some really incredible images in there. It's very image heavy in a very good way. It adds to the book quite a bit. And I'm wondering how you got all those images and what archives one uses to access the animal history of a city.
Well, certainly the images are available in a variety of different sources, and some are available online through the University of Washington and the Seattle Municipal Archives and our Mohai Museum, the Museum of History and Industry, which is the Seattle and broader Puget Sound region history museum. So all of those have these images, but I think you have to do a lot of scanning the images themselves. They're not always indexed with the names of the animals. So I spent a fair amount of time going through the images, say, at the University of Washington and looking at street scenes. And then occasionally you'll see a cow in a backyard or a cow in a street that might have escaped other people's attention. So I think it's looking at sources that are widely available, but looking at them in a different way. And then I was very fortunate that as a book indexer, I'd say I'm very fortunate that the Seattle Municipal Archives has been very well indexed, and individual petitions that were filed were indexed by categories, including animals involved. I was able to find a whole collection of petitions about cows in the city and petitions about dogs and cats, and able to look up some of the names of the petition signers and correlate them with the city directories and find occupations. So I was able to build a lot of information from the excellent indexing of the collections at the Municipal Archives, and also the State Archives have some of the property records which show the importance of animals and how they were treated as property, but also allow you to see who owned cows at a certain time. And again, you can look at their occupations, or even the property records might show their household worth. So you can make various assertions about family income and animals owned. So it's not the main thing people look for in archives, but that information is there in a city that's kept a lot of the petitions that got to the city.
And you mentioned with the images, looking at images in a different way. And I was struck by how many of the pictures that are in the book, the images that are in the book, in a different kind of book, might just be sort of your almost generic city scene. But because they're in a book about the animal history of animals, or of a city, excuse me, the animals really jump out. And I thought it was very well done. I really liked that part of the book.
Thanks.
So before we turn to the urban history of animals in the Puget Sound region, can you provide a brief overview of the early history of Seattle? When was the city founded, and who lived in the region prior to the arrival of Europeans?
The Salish people, and including the Duwamish people, who have lived and continue to live in what is currently Seattle. Salish people have been here for millennia, since time immemorial, and had an economy where the salmon were incredibly important and where animals were incredibly important. You see that, among other things, in the names they use for places on the landscape. The names that newcomers have attached to places in Seattle are often the names of people, and like the street names, the neighborhood names. But if you look at a list of the names of civic places that Duwamish people used, a number of them refer to fishes or beavers or ducks or other animals that are important part of their life. So Salish people have been here since time immemorial, and Europeans and other newcomers first came to Puget Sound in a semi-permanent way with the fur trade in the 1830s, setting up Fort Nisqually about 40 miles south of what is now Seattle. And Seattle was founded in 1851 when the Denny Party arrived and also the Luther Collins Party arrived that year. And so Seattle was founded in 1851, and an important part of the economy was the lumber in the region. And Seattle grew, and a big point of its becoming quite a bit bigger was the gold rush of the 1890s, when this was a jumping-off point for people heading to the Klondike in Alaska and Canada to mine for gold. So the economy boomed then, and Seattle became much larger. So Seattle's history of the region goes back millennia, but the founding of Seattle was in 1851.
And animals, of course, were present from day one of European settlement and conquest within the Puget Sound region. How were animals a part of early Seattle, and what did they symbolize for different groups of people in the city's early history?
Yes, animals were crucial in the founding of Seattle, and there's just a whole suite of animals that Europeans had, that Americans had in the eastern United States, and they brought all of them here very quickly. And in some ways, in the context of the fur trade, there was a sense that these Europeans wanted to create an economy with European-style agriculture, and animals were a crucial part of that. So they brought cattle, pigs, and chickens, and cats and dogs, and geese and ducks and bees. And within 10 years, this whole suite of animals was there. And these animals were crucial in many ways, and an important way to note is that they're important in the land claims that Europeans made, that the very land laws that were used to assert a European control of property included implicitly animals. There was an Oregon Donation Act that many of the founders used to claim land. There was language saying that white people could claim a certain amount of land if it was cultivated. And the information that was used in legal documents to prove land was cultivated were the source of structures and buildings that were needed for animals, like stables and fences and coops. So animals were essential and woven into people's sense of, to European sense of ownership and of land being cultivated. So that had an important legal sense and that important symbolic sense of you know, familiar reminders of life in other parts of the United States and a sign of progress that they had animals here that were also in the eastern United States.
And as people arrive from the east, and as you put it, they bring this suite of animals with them, what happens to the region's predators who had existed prior to European arrival?
Right, so there was a whole change in the animals that had land and that had what they needed to survive. And there was this conflict between domestic and wild animals. So in order to create a safe space, especially for cows that had often wandered far from the city, the newcomers made an assertive effort to kill cougars and wolves and other creatures that threatened those. So their numbers decreased greatly, and there was an agricultural system that was kind of halfway between wild and domestic, where cows would wander far from the city and would not be completely controlled by those who owned them, but they would come home at the end of the day to get their food or even to get fodder or even to be reunited with their calves. So the set of animals that were here changed greatly, and of course animals took their own actions in some ways to take advantage of this changing environment. There's stories, for instance, of crows watching hogs on the beach picking up clams, and crows following the hogs to get a little bit of the clams themselves. So animals the animals that had always been there were certainly harmed, but they also found new opportunities.
And you mentioned cows, and cattle are an animal that pop up repeatedly throughout your history of Seattle, which I thought was interesting because, at least for myself, cows are not an animal that I readily associate with cities, at least not in 2018. So can you tell us a little bit about what you call the cattle history of the city and what that history can tell us about Seattle's changing urban geography?
Yeah, cows seem like one of the most important animals in early Seattle and even in the 1890s, early 20th century as the city was growing. And I think there's a cultural importance to newcomers to have a source of milk, which was a familiar food from back east. There are stories from the year of the founding in 1851 that they had to rely on clam juice. They didn't have milk. And that story was repeated. It kind of shows the importance of milk to a sense of identity. And the legal system provided a freedom for cows that it really didn't for other large domestic animals, and in various ways at different times provided provisions that allowed a family to let a cow roam free in certain areas of the city so the cow could graze in what I call the cow commons, not a specific place like the Boston Common, but open, undeveloped lots, the edge of town where there was places to graze, or even the streets. There are places to graze. So the law provided that there would be a way for families to keep a cow. They might be limited to one or two cows for families, that sometimes they had to wear a collar with an ID number on it. But the cows were seen as a sign of progress, that this was becoming a more Europeanized place. And then at a certain point, they came to be seen as backward, and then there were struggles about removing them from neighborhoods.
Yeah, you talk a lot in the book about kind of the changing symbols and of animals and what animals represent and how historically contingent those representations are. So as you tell it, cows to some people come to represent essentially everything that a city should not be fairly early on in the 20th century. Horses, however, have a somewhat more complicated relationship to this idea of modernity and what a modern city should look like. Can you tell us about horses as workers and as changing symbols in early 20th century Seattle?
No, yeah, those two animals are the two biggest, most prevalent domestic animals, and cows become a symbol of backwardness. But horses... And cows are sort of removed through legal means, making it illegal for them to wander publicly. But horses are really only kind of very gradually removed from, say, 1900 until 1940, as people made a choice to remove them. I think they had a very different position because they, for much longer, were a symbol of modernity and a symbol of progress in the city. They did a lot of the work in creating the city. The width of the streets had been set up wide enough that a carriage could turn around in them. Horses did the work of digging out excavations for buildings. They did some of the work of regrading downtown, of smoothing out the hills downtown to allow commerce to happen more easily. And there are even photographs of them, helping install electrical equipment. So the horses were seen as a sign of the modern city, even say in 1900, and for instance, stationery of businesses and public entities would have pictures of horses to show this is a dynamic, important place, whereas cows would never be in those sorts of images. And there are any number of problems with horses that advocates for automobiles recognized, and such as the humane concern about the suffering of horses, the sanitary concerns about horses. There was a problem of the willfulness of horses, that they could run wild and create havoc. But their importance is shown by the fact that as long as they're economically important, all of those problems, people put up with them and found ways to mitigate them or to deal with them because horses were essential to the economy of the city until automobiles gradually proved to be more efficient at moving at moving commerce and people in the city. And automobiles replaced not only horses, but they replaced walking and public transportation to some extent. So the horses followed a very different trajectory than cows had.
So I myself am a cat owner, and so I really enjoyed your chapter in the middle of the book about cats and dogs in urban Seattle. Can you talk a bit about the history of pets in cities such as Seattle and when dogs and cats and animals of that nature start to become more common than cows and horses and other large animals that we might classify as livestock?
Sure. I mean, that was a big transition of the 20th century from cows and horses and chickens being the most common prevalent animals people knew to cats and dogs, although cats and dogs had always been here. And I've been a proud cat owner most of my life. Unfortunately, I'm not right now, but that's an important part of my life. So I think that's very important. And the role of cats and dogs changed a great deal in the 20th century from a very complex role that kind of mixed friendship and work in the early 20th century. You see in many ways that that dogs and cats were expected to do work. The cats had important work in getting rid of mice and rats and protecting grain, protecting stores. And there are various images in the book of a cat that's an important part of the team at a grocery store, an important member of the crew on a ship. And there are also dogs who had very important work in guarding property and in helping with hunting. And you often would see ads in the newspaper that people would say they had a dog that was both a good friend to children and a good guard dog. And so those roles were very combined. But I think because they were kept often for economic importance, their numbers were smaller, and people, you know, generally only kept them when they needed them. But as there is greater prosperity and as there are consumer innovations and technological innovations that made keeping dogs and cats easier, like cat litter and canned dog and cat food, as people could afford those more, the number of dogs and cats increased. And as the primary reason for keeping them became affection, almost, you know, not everybody, but and most people appreciate the affection of either dogs or cats. So the numbers increased, you know, 5 or 10 fold, at least dogs, the numbers increased 5 or 10 fold per capita through the 20th century. And through the last half of the 20th century, I think certainly not 100%, but for most people, the importance of cats and dogs is that they're family members and friends and sources of affection and comfort and interaction. And I think, you know, it's an exact reason for those changes are hard to say because it's in the area of sentiment and connection, and the sources aren't as detailed as about economic things. But I think there's sort of three big reasons, and one is economic growth, that people can afford these animals. One is the departure of livestock, and I think that people feel that desire to interact with animals, with cats and dogs. And I think another reason is people having fewer children, and that for many people their connection with the animals become closer when they have fewer family members. So the role of cats and dogs has changed a great deal, and now they're as far as the animals we think about and interact with and are conscious about, they're most prevalent in our minds.
And as those animals become more prevalent in our minds, you argue that this gives rise to what you call the paradox of the pet food dish. Can you describe what that paradox is and what its sort of large-scale effects are?
Right. So that's the big theme of how these things change, that there's this great paradox that, you know, those of us who own cats and dogs, that moment of feeding a cat or dog in the pet food dish is that moment of connection and care and concern and helping a beloved friend, but it's also a moment of indifference, generally in ignorance, about the lives of the faraway cattle, pigs, and chickens, and sheep, or fish, or other animals that were killed to make that cat food. So there's this paradox that as we talk more and more about benevolence, and as as benevolence becomes more and more important, we're often more and more ignorant about the faraway lives of animals that feed us. So there's been this sort of growing dichotomy between pet and livestock through the 20th century, that livestock in early 20th century often had some kind of personal relationship with the end user. People often knew the chicken in their backyard that provided them eggs and might eventually provide them with meat. People often knew the cow that provided the milk. People saw horses working in the streets. So that the role of a pure worker that provided a service or a product and sentient being that one was aware of were mixed. Whereas as livestock moved farther and farther from the city, their lives became something that city people knew less and less about, and that leads to this paradox of benevolence and use, that as we focus more on benevolence, we are using and exploiting an ever greater number of faraway animals.
So a couple minutes ago, you told a bit of the history of dogs and cats in Seattle. But earlier, you also mentioned that Seattle had a cow commons. And later on, you talk about Seattle as a dog commons in kind of the middle years of the 20th century. What do you mean by a dog commons? And how does that change as we get later into the 20th century?
Right. So a dog commons is a term that I've forgotten who I got it from. It wasn't my term, but it's this notion that until the leash law of 1958, dogs had the right to roam free if they had a license. So common space was devoted to things that were important to people, and it was important enough that if you could have a license, I think it might have been $5 in the early 20th century, which precluded a lot of people from having dogs. If you had that license, your dog could roam free, and that was created a very different sort of relationship with dogs. I think in some way there's been a privatization of dogs that in the 30s and 40s, dogs roamed in neighborhoods and the various children in the neighborhood might play with a dog they knew, or a dog might go to school to meet children and go home with them. So it kind of interacted in public place. But as dogs became privatized, everyone who wanted that sort of interaction had to had their own dogs, and they had to be on leashes and had to be confined in houses. So the dog commons disappeared from, and there were debates and letters and petitions, especially from the 1930s to the 1950s. And at least in Seattle, I think the issue that first brought this to people's attention was rabies and a rabies scare in the early 30s. But the discussion moved away from that. It was really focused on property, really focused on the signs of a prosperous, nice middle-class home with lawns and bushes and shrubs and flowers and the way that dogs threaten those. And those concerns became greater and greater until the city passed a leash law, not unanimously, but I believe around 57% of the people voted in favor of a leash law in 1957. So so part of the reason for enforcing that was to protect the growing sense of a middle class home that wasn't about producing eggs or producing milk. It was about affection and connection between people and animals, and about having a city where you could have a nice lawn and flowers and have it not be threatened by dogs.
So again, it comes down to an extent to dogs and animals as symbols and what they mean in within a city itself.
Right. So I think, dogs, all animals have these important roles, I think, as friends and property and symbols. And certainly free-roaming dogs are a symbol of a backward city that people wanted to get rid of in the 1950s.
Yeah. So finally, you very rightfully point out toward the end of the book the importance of salmon in the human history of Seattle. Tell us why this fish has had such a contentious and also such an important history throughout Seattle's past.
Right. I thought it was important to talk about salmon because many of these stories in this book are broadly true throughout the United States, with changes for different local conditions, but the salmon is in some ways unique in Seattle that I don't think there are not many cities where indigenous people have fished the salmon in this place for millennia, and they still do. So that is that continuity of the importance of salmon, but their lives have changed greatly, and there have been great struggles over salmon through the years, and an important struggle was the right of indigenous people to fish for salmon in their usual in accustomed places. That's a language from the treaties of the 1850s, by which the U.S. government took land from the Salish people, but also made this promise, and that promise of fishing rights was often ignored, and wildlife officials would prevent Salish people from fishing, and so the fishing movement began in the 1960s and led to the Volt decision of the 1970s that gave indigenous people half of the fish that were available in different fisheries. So it's been that struggle over salmon. And salmon, I think, for newcomers generally have this changing role as well. But I think in the early history of the city, they were seen as a sign that it was a very different place from the eastern United States and not a sign of progress. And I think the early white settlers looked forward to having beef and having bread and having more familiar foods. But in the last 10 or 20 or 30 years, salmon had become a symbol of Seattle and a symbol of a connection to the natural world, and has become very important to many in Seattle to help preserve them and the city, and also in order to follow the strictures of the Endangered Species Act, the city has been forced to try to mitigate damage to fish's habitat. So there's been all this series of struggles over salmon, and they have been a part of life here for millennia, and they continue to swim through the waterways of Seattle. So they show this great continuity, but also this great change through Seattle's history.
And again, thinking about animals as symbols, salmon almost come to represent a symbol of Seattle itself in certain ways. They become very closely associated with the Puget Sound region and Seattle itself.
Right, they become the symbol, and yeah, Mayor Schell says that maybe the salmon will save us, that the efforts to preserve the salmon bring people of different ideologies together and create a unifying symbol for the city, even though in an earlier time they were seen as a symbol that this place was backwards. So I think the salmon are important to many people, both as a source of food and as something to push people to have environmental preservation and create habitat where salmon can survive.
I hesitate to ask a historian to do any prognostication, but at the same time, this book feels very open-ended. This history feels very open-ended, and you kind of leave it on a fairly open-ended note. So I'm just curious what you see as the changing role of animals within Seattle, where you still live today, and how you might see that role changing in the future.
Right. Well, I guess the question is whether existing trends will continue, or whether there will be a shift. But there's been this trend of separating beloved animals from used animals more and more throughout history. And like one possibility is that will just continue, and will lavish more and more affection on cats and dogs, and become more and more ignorant about the lives of faraway animals. But I think there are maybe some signs that some of those things are shifting, that vegetarianism and veganism have always been only a small minority of city people in Seattle and in the U.S., but the amount of meat people are consuming has started to come down starting in 2005. And there are greater efforts to know something about the lives of the animals that produce our faraway food. There are various words on the food we buy about organic or cage-free or humane certified. And those words are often hard to decipher, and some of them they don't have much meaning, but I think they indicate desire on the part of some people to be more aware of these faraway animals. So it's certainly my hope that in thinking about all the animals that have been a part of urban life and thinking about the ways that all the animals that were important to city people were immediately visible in the streets and in backyards 100 years ago, I hope that encourages people to try to bridge that gap and become aware of those animals that are now far away and are part of their life as they make choices about how they want to live on this planet and in this city that we human beings share with a number of other creatures who have important interests and important desires themselves.
Untangling the paradox of the pet food dish, you might think of it as.
Yes, I hope that I certainly can't resolve that paradox, but I think that thinking through these issues can allow each reader to understand that more and maybe find some way of dealing with that paradox in a more honest, open way than awareness of all the animals that are part of our lives.
So, Fred, now that this book is finished and winning awards, what are you working on next? What do you have on your plate coming up?
Well, I'm starting research and thinking about English sparrows and European starlings and how they made their way across this continent. I guess this book about Seattle tried to look at some of the most important animals in economy and legal issues, and I want to look at a couple of animals that to most people are not very important, but that managed to be introduced in the Eastern United States and to spread across the continent, and especially to think about the way that intersects with ideas about immigration and so this curious way in which many people thought bringing starlings and sparrows were familiar reminders of home, and for European immigrants, they're a way to belong in the United States and to make the United States a familiar place with familiar animals. And then more recently, in the last few decades, it's been there's been a focus on native plants, and a way that people assert their belonging here is by hating these English sparrows and European starlings. So their place has changed a great deal. So I want to think about their role in immigration and the changing landscape of the United States and look at these avian immigrants who conquered the continent and are now in almost all of the 48 contiguous states.
Well, that sounds great. And when it's done, we will have you back on the podcast.
That would be great.
Frederick Brown is an independent historian and is the author of The City is More Than Human, An Animal History of Seattle, which came out in 2016 with the University of Washington Press and recently won the WHA's Hal K. Rothman Award. Fred, thanks again for joining us.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure to be here.